Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This hour on The Brian Lehrer Show, Dahlia Lithwick from Slate wonders about public opinion and the Supreme Court. Does it matter what people think about constitutional rights? And Joel Stein from Time Magazine wonders about fatherhood and masculinity. We'll hear about his sometimes serious, sometimes funny search for his inner man. But we are now in the home stretch of our spring membership drive. After Wednesday, you won't hear another day of pledge programming until October. And if you become a member now or renew your membership now, you won't have to think about it the whole rest of the year. So before we dive into Dahlia Lithwick here in just a second, we request that you keep it in mind this morning. Please support public radio at 1-888-376-WNYC, 1-888-376-9692, or pledge online at WNYC.org. We'll talk more about it later, but if it works for you, maybe you can get your pledge in right now. Thanks again. All right. Now, Dahlia Lithwick, senior editor and Supreme Court watcher at Slate. You've heard her on this program a lot over the years, and she joins us now to talk about an issue she wrote about recently and something we've been thinking about in our office, too, public opinion and the Supreme Court. This keeps coming up. Should it matter what people think about Citizens United or Obamacare? Dahlia, welcome back to WNYC.
Hi there, Brian. Thank you for having me.
So you wrote that the fixation on public opinion polling and the Constitution is bad news for the Supreme Court and maybe for our democracy. What's the danger?
Well, at the most obvious level, just as a normative matter, the court's not supposed to care about what the polls say. The court is actually supposed to be the one branch of government that is, by definition, counter-majoritarian, by definition, protects the rights of minorities and protects the interests of those who are not doing well in the polls. And so the simple answer is the court shouldn't care. It looks bad when the court does care. But we still know after centuries that the court cares about the polls. And so this becomes an interesting question. How does the court watch the polls? What does it think about the polls? How does it take that information and braid it into what it does?
And relevant to right now, you wrote with your co-author Barry Friedman about how public opinion polling is playing out in the Obama health reform case currently before the Supreme Court. So talk about how polling was included, at least in the media coverage of these oral arguments earlier in the year.
Well, that was, to us, I think, the trigger to write this piece was that it was really astounding the extent to which every single day of the three-day arguments, news about polls was either included in the main stories about the arguments or right next to it. And we flagged the New York Times that, the very first day of oral arguments, the New York Times was putting up, sort of constitutional news right next to public opinion news. And so we had this sense that, wow, this has become really a case in which what people think about the constitutionality of Obamacare has become as important, if not more important, than the legal issue. So there was just a sense that the polling was driving the coverage, and that was really interesting. And I think there's been a real, in the weeks since the case was argued, as we wait for the decision to come down, a very real sense that the media is gaming this. Almost every week someone puts up a piece about how this is polling and how the court's going to poll and how, if the court strikes down the ACA, what the polls will do and what it will mean for the election. So it's been so bound up with the conversation of, that's supposed to be a very, very bare-bones conversation about the Commerce Clause and doctrine, has always been really, really bound up with this conversation about what the public thinks. And that's really, I think, quite new.
When you say the ACA, that, of course, refers to the Affordable Care Act, which is the Obama health reform law. Do you think there's really a danger on either side, for example, that the justices will think that because the Affordable Care Act may not be polling well, that they then have political cover to strike it down?
I think that has certainly been a big theme in all the talking about this. I think there's been a sense that really for a long time that the health care bill had polled well, the justices would not have been emboldened to, you know, behave as they did at argument, which is sort of looking like they're poised to strike it down, whether or not they do strike it down. So I do think there is a sound argument that says they have cover because the public hates this thing. But I think even more fundamentally, what we've really seen happen is a discussion about if the justices do strike it down or partly strike it down or uphold it, how this is going to play and how the court somehow is worried about, you know, the Romney-Obama election. And so we don't only have this question about what the public thinks and how the court is interpreting that, but that the court is so political that it's gauging what the numbers say out there in terms of thinking through what's the best thing for the election. And that, again, is very, very bad, not just for the court, but for the country. And I should add that, you know, a poll that was done here, we're talking about the evils of polls, so let me cite a poll. A poll that was done right after the argument showed that 50% of Americans fully expect a completely partisan ruling from the court. So this isn't happening at a moment when Americans are real happy with the court as neutral arbiters of justice.
Dahlia Lithwick from Slate on the relationship between public opinion polling and the constitutional judgment that Supreme Court justices are supposed to be making on things like Citizens United and the Obama health reform law. 212-433-WNYC. And Steve in Glen Cove, you're on the air. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Brian. Good morning. This is an excellent topic. I just wanted to comment and then hear your guest's response, Talia's response. Both Sandra Day O'Connor, right around the time of her retirement, as well as Andrew Souter a couple of years thereafter, explicitly commented on this very topic. And Sandra Day O'Connor said, well, of course, ultimately, we reflect public opinion. Justice Souter brought up the fact several years after at a commencement ceremony, I can't remember where, and I'm parked in my car. I can't, because I can't search it.
It's okay. We don't need the name of the college.
Right. He explicitly said, look at Plessy versus Ferguson, and then fast forward 50 some odd years to Brown versus Board of Education. What changed? Nothing except public opinion of African Americans. That's the only thing that changed, and that's subsequently what changed the attitude of the Supreme Court. And I'll take your comments off the air because it's a very interesting topic.
Steve, thank you very much. And I guess that kind of separates it out into two questions because you're saying what you think should be, Dahlia, which is that the court, at least in theory, in the, you know, the purest sense, is not supposed to take into account public opinion because that's kind of mob rule, which is what the Constitution is supposed to protect political minorities against. On the other hand, when public opinion in the real world finally changed away from official segregation, it enabled Brown versus Board to overturn the Supreme Court's own words in Plessy.
That's exactly right. And I think undergirding what Steve says, you know, the other interesting issue that's coming up now has to do with gay marriage, where we're having exactly this conversation about whether the courts should be leading or following the public trends. And so exactly the framing that you just gave is the debate that has happened in the last 2 weeks when President Obama said, you know, he believes in the right to gay marriage, but he believes that it's a state-by-state issue. A lot of folks felt that it's not a state-by-state issue, that gay rights are a fundamental constitutional right, and they should be pushed by the courts. And so there's been exactly this fight about whether the courts should be sort of holding back, waiting for public opinion to change. There's a really deep, deep scholarship, Brian, on the backlash that happens when the court gets out ahead of public opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And we talk about that in the article that I wrote with Barry Friedman in 1972 when the court did away with the death penalty. The backlash was so acute. There's, I think, a lot of scholarship that shows that the backlash to Roe really did cause the hardening of the objections to abortion in this country. So the court always has to kind of triangulate against what is right, what is constitutional, and then this other issue, you know, protecting minorities, as you said, but this other issue of, is the public ready? Because if the public isn't ready, the backlash could be so profound that you set back the very cause you're trying to espouse.
Lower court judges, of course, don't have the lifetime appointments of Supreme Court justices. So if they defy majority public opinion, they get labeled activist judges and could get ousted the next time they're up for election. I'm thinking, for example, about the Iowa state Supreme Court judges who ruled to approve same-sex marriage. Three of those judges were actively campaigned against and ousted. So even though they thought they were just interpreting the Iowa Constitution as protecting everybody's right to get married to another individual under state constitutional language, it turns out they had a lot to worry about with respect to public opinion, not just polls.
I just want to just clarify that it's not the difference between lower court judges. It's the difference between, because obviously federal lower court judges are also appointed for life. It's the difference between state and federal judges, just to be completely clear.
Thank you.
But yes, you're quite right. In states that elect their judges, and most states elect some judges, there is an absolute backlash that doesn't just take the effect of, you know, public opinion hardening against this position. But as you said, careers are ended. And that obviously loops back to what we said at the very beginning, which is the framers intended for the judiciary to be protected from that kind of backlash. The idea was that if the justices have to answer to polls and to public opinion, and particularly I think in the Iowa example you just gave, huge amounts of dollars funding election races, then the justices or judges cannot do their work. So I think what you're saying is exactly what I believe to be the case, which is judges, if they are held to account in an election, are going to have a problem doing exactly what we think that they should be doing.
And here's one local example of the use of public opinion polling with respect to a constitutional issue. And it comes from New York City's own Mayor Bloomberg responding to that federal judge ruling in the favor of a class action status in the stop and frisk case last week. In the ruling, Judge Shira Scheindlin said the police department's, quote, cavalier attitude toward the prospect of a widespread practice of suspicionless stops displays a deeply troubling apathy toward New Yorkers' most fundamental constitutional rights. That was the judge. Here was Mayor Bloomberg's response.
If you went out and surveyed the public, you would find overwhelming support for what we're doing, and a handful of people who have a right to express themselves feel differently.
That was so fascinating because it was so stark. The court, federal court, is considering a constitutional question with respect to how stop and frisk is conducted. And the mayor comes out, you know, explicitly on public opinion and says, oh, no, but most people support it.
Well, and it goes again to this really, really systemic problem that judges have, whether they're elected or appointed, whether they're in a state system or a federal system, which is that the judicial branch has been so politicized in the last few decades, and folks are awfully comfortable coming out and talking about judges and their wrongs, particularly in election states where, you know, you have unbelievable attack ads that, you know, again, financed by, you know, millions of dollars from out of state, and the judges are bound by oath not to respond. So it depends on which code of ethics you're looking at. But those Iowa justices that were ousted that you mentioned didn't respond to the attack ads. They, in fact, felt that they couldn't respond to the attack ads because it's outside of the judicial ethical canon. So attacks on the judiciary are really different from other kinds of political attacks because judges can't fight back.
There we have Dahlia Lithwick from Slate's thoughts about how public opinion unfortunately intersects with what judges have to consider from the bench in terms of our constitutional rights, a fascinating thing to think about in this era of media saturation in context of the way Mayor Bloomberg tried to use public opinion against the court last week, in the context of what the Supreme Court is now considering with respect to the Obama health reform law. Very thoughtful from Dahlia Lithwick from Slate. Dahlia, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Brian.
Brian Lehrer from on WNYC. Still to come, Joel Stein from Time Magazine wonders about fatherhood and masculinity. We'll hear about his sometimes serious, sometimes funny search for his inner man on the occasion of the birth of his son. Stay with us.